The first reading this morning comes from the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures. It's from the book of Shemot, or Exodus, and it's about the prop, if you will, made famous in the film Raiders of the Lost Ark. The word ark just means box or coffer, and so I have translated it. The word cherubim, or cherubim in Hebrew, is usually left untranslated in English, but it means a winged sphinx, not little baby angels floating on clouds, as it's come to mean. More on that during the sermon.
Let them make a rectangular box out of acacia wood. Let it be 2.5 feet in length and 1.5 feet in width and depth. Cover the wooden box inside and outside with gold beaten into fine foil. Cast 4 rings for the 4 corners, attach them, and carve 2 poles to slide through each of the 2 set of rings so that the box might be carried. Out of pure gold, cast a cover for the whole box that resembles a traditional footstool. Into the box, put the testimonies I have given you. Then please carve 2 winged lions with human faces, sphinxes. Cover them with gold foil, affix them to the cover, and place them facing each other with their wings spread out over them, above them, as if to shelter the cover. I will meet with you there, between the sphinxes, above the golden cover that resembles a footstool.
The second reading comes from a 1990 essay of the great poet Denise Levertov called Work That Invades. I've always loved her poetry, but she was also a very fine prose writer.
Invisible wings are given to us, by which, if we would dare to acknowledge and use them, we might transcend the dualities of time and spirit. But by persistently saying no, we experience our wings as a dragging weight on our backs.
You spotted snakes with double tongue, thorny hedgehogs be not seen. Newts and blind worms do no wrong, come not near our fairy queen. Fill our mill with melody, singing our sweet lullaby. Lula, lule, lullaby. Lula, lule, lullaby. Good night with lullaby. Fill our mill with melody, singing our sweet. Lullaby.
I think we're very privileged to have original compositions this morning. I think it's really quite a gift of the season. Thank you, Dee. By now, I have to admit, I'm growing tired of it. When I walk down the street, I see signs declaring it. I see the signs proclaiming it festooned on T-shirts at the mall. I hear the words spoken on television and on the car radio. I see the words across the screens of my computer on websites or on circulars that come to the church office. What is it? The words, Jesus is the reason for the season. Personally, I am not convinced that Jesus is the reason for the season. Now, don't get me wrong. I revere and always have revered the authentic wisdom of Jesus found in the New Testament, critically examined. I think even the fabled birth stories are rich with meaning. But I really can think of a few other reasons for the season. But that does not seem to make many folks who preach Jesus is the reason for the season very happy. It never feels like an invitation to theological conversation when they say it to me. No, it always feels like I'm being scolded for just not getting it right. Somehow I'm doing Christmas wrong. Just like all those Jews who insist on lighting those stupid menorahs instead of getting with the program. Or those strange Jehovah's Witnesses and a few of those really angry atheists who refuse to celebrate Christmas altogether. Or those Sierra Club types and earth-centered mystics who prate on and on about the whole season really just being much ado about the solstice. Or all those scholars who keep on telling us that it never really happened the way the Bible tells us so. Or those agnostics and tepid religious types, like those Unitarians or whatever they're called, who enjoy the culture of Christmas trees and the splendid and unique music of the carols, and who are happy to give a few helpful gifts and sing about peace on earth and a few rounds of Gloria in Excelsis Deo during the season. My thesis this morning focuses on only one word in that dreadful proclamation, Jesus is the reason for the season. I already told you I don't have any problem with Jesus, at least as I understand him. And seasons are just seasons. They come and they go. Period. So, no problem there. And I have a great deal of respect for reason, naturally, as a minister in a living tradition that has always relied on a respectful use of reason in regard to religion. No, my problem is entirely with the word the. I have a problem with the word the almost everywhere it's used. Doesn't make any difference who uses it, someone who's deeply religious or someone who wants to set churches on fire, someone who believes lots or someone who believes hardly anything at all. For example, if someone, like a former seminary student I knew, actually tells me that my late grandfather, who was an atheist, was not the atheist he should have been because he actually celebrated Christmas with the rest of his family, I flinch in pain. If someone like the preacher Jimmy Swaggart, who's still on television, folks, suggests that my dying mother is going to hell because she is not the real Christian, the real Christian he is, she being a mere Catholic, as he would say, I wince in pain. Right or left, up or down makes no difference. I recoil when I hear the word the used about almost anything. It's the chief word used by any kind of Puritan in the world. When I hear it, it says to me that someone somewhere actually knows, once and for all, the final and pure truth. It says to me it's actually possible that a few people know the absolute truth and that a majority of people in this world are simply, well, stupid. Right and wrong, true and false, this and that, dualities, clear dualities dividing the world into two, and only two sides, the righteous and the damned, the brilliance and the fools, the believers and the infidels, the skeptics and the credulous, those who think Jesus is the reason for the season, and everyone else. So personally, I find a great deal of redemptive comfort in the midst of the season when I read Denise Levertov's words. Remember what she said? Invisible wings are given to us by which, if we would dare acknowledge and use them, we might transcend the dualities of time and spirit. Levertov should know a little bit about transcending dualities. Her family had Jewish and Christian ancestors. She herself claimed to be agnostic with deep doubts about everything, yet always used rich Catholic religious imagery in her poetry. And she loved the ceremony of Holy Communion. She refused to split her beautiful poetry from her fierce liberal politics. She did not divide herself into two. She did not slice herself up into believer and non-believer, Jew or Christian. She recognized that she had wings, which enabled her to transcend the dualities of time and spirit. Her Hasidic Jewish father walked through her writings no less than her Welsh Christian mother. Falling under the spell of the Unitarians Emerson and Thoreau at the same time as she attended Mass, she refused to deny either her faith or her doubt. She did not find her eclectic spirituality to be a weakness, but a power. Not a lazy default, but a saving strength. She was not a Puritan, where everything boils down to this or that. Now, you're certainly welcome to think of Denise Levertov as a creature of the modern world, a world of airplanes and transportation where Welsh Anglican women can meet German Hasidic Jews just like that. You're also welcome to point out that the modern world is being completely transformed by the internet and that a boy in Tehran can now talk face to face with a girl in Paris on Skype just like that. Whereas in the old days, they would never have met or knew that each other existed. You are welcome to think that the Puritanism of modern fanatics, whether political or religious, left or right, no matter, who know the truth while everyone else is deluded, is a result of fear. Fear that their world is growing smaller because of all this internet-fed multicultural blending and meeting and fusing across boundaries. I have a different understanding. I think Puritan thinkers, people who are convinced there is only one, the truth, and they know it, have always been afraid. I don't think fear is new. I think they have always shouted and been loud and scolding. I think they have always done this because I, for one, am convinced the world has never been pure. It's been a mix from the very beginning. It's been a jumble since day one. It's been interracial, multicultural, and interfaith from the very beginning. This week, Jews around the world are celebrating Hanukkah, as most of you know. It's not considered a major holiday by the rabbis. It's just a minor observance, except in places like North America, where Christmas is the big deal, capitalize both words. Here, where you have all those proclamations of Jesus as the reason for the season coming out every hour on the hour, you just might find yourself, quite understandably, I'd say, were you Jewish, in a rather competitive mode. Just in order not to be washed away by the deluge of Christmas. And thus, the Hanukkah bush goes up in some Jewish homes. The story of Hanukkah is told and retold with picture books to children. And there is stress on presents equal in value to what might be found under Christmas trees. Religious customs, you see, are blending and influencing each other. Cultural edges are being smudged. But I'm telling you this morning, it's always been that way. This is not new. Biblical Abraham, after all, was not a Jew. He was a Sumerian, the story says, from the city of Ur. Moses has a thoroughly Egyptian, un-Hebrew name. The famous warrior chieftain David had immigrants like Uriah the Hittite in his entourage. And the city of Jerusalem itself, from its very beginning, was built at the crossroads of the world, with Egypt to the south, Assyria to the east, Hatti and Mitanni to the north. The highways connecting the city of Jerusalem to the world, understandably, did not have the speed of the internet, but so what? They still managed to communicate culture with culture. And those cultures connected, and they blended and influenced each other from the very beginning. They became something new. They were no longer pure. They transcended the dualities of time and spirit, them and us, this and that, you and me. And they became alive to the realities of their time and place. If you look at the sacred shrine of the Hebrew people, the portable box filled with the documents found on Mount Sinai, and famously translated as the Ark of the Covenant, you can see the perfect example of this ancient multiculturalism from 3,000 years ago. The text you heard this morning spoke of winged lions with human faces, images that were to be affixed by the crafter onto the golden cover of the sacred box. The Hebrew word for winged lions with human faces is cherubim, or cherubim. Since the dawn of the Renaissance paintings by people like Raphael in the West and the proliferation of overly sentimental art on Christmas cards, cherubs have become little baby angels floating on clouds. But the word never meant that. It meant the kind of sphinx that you can see on the cover of your orders of celebration. An amazing fusion of Egyptian art with Assyrian art mixed with some details of the Hittites. The cherubim on top of the sacred chest of the Hebrews reflected not Puritan rigidity, but fluid, eclectic ideals. The wings of an eagle fused to the powerful muscles of a lion, all fused to a human face, making a new image that transcends the dualities of time and spirit, even that long ago. Eventually, when the sacred coffer was given a permanent home in a stone temple, the architects, following local and borrowed Phoenician custom, framed the box itself with two giant cherubim, sphinxes covered with beaten gold. Archaeologists have found many similar multicultural sphinx images from that era. They were everywhere because there is no real way to stop cultural fusions, you see, unless you think taking up the tactics of scolding and loud preaching, favored by the Jesus is the reason for the season types, will help you to achieve that strange goal of Puritanism. Or worse, outright force and bloody violence, as favored by the Greek occupation force of Jerusalem back in the days of the first Hanukkah. But hear me now. Hanukkah may compete with Christmas in modern America, but it's not like Christmas at all. It is not associated with the solstice. It is not about new birth. It is not even about peace and goodwill. And it is not about the Hebrew tradition, which was just at that time starting to become what we now call the Jewish tradition, being better than the Greek tradition. No, not at all. Both traditions had wisdom to offer, and they still do have wisdom to offer. They're distinct cultures, to be sure, but they're both wise. Whether you wear your hair long or short, whether you practice circumcision or not, and the Egyptians used to practice it too, you know, whether you think God can be portrayed in artwork, or whether you think, like the Jews insisted, that God cannot be portrayed or named or talked about at all, is really not terribly significant, as far as I'm concerned. To say it was significant would be to lift mere cultural insight to the level of ultimacy. But what Hanukkah is about is that no one gets to force anyone else to take up their culture or their understanding of intimacy. Wearing your hair long is not more holy than cutting it short, but forcing someone to wear long hair or cut it off, either way, as the Greeks did insist of the Jewish men in those days, is not a holy thing at all. Force is never holy. It's futile, and it's misguided, and it's sad. I don't like a war as a solution to anything, but the Maccabeans were not wrong to revolt against violence and force. When we Unitarian Universalists talk of freedom as one of our root values, we have never meant, and I want you to hear this, we have never meant by that word freedom to do whatever you want. That's a rather infantile understanding of so great a word. Our tradition, like the Maccabean tradition, has insisted that freedom means that nobody has the right to use force or violence to make anyone do anything or believe something they do not believe. We didn't tell the English monarchy or the Dutch parliament they had no right to be Anglicans or they should stop being members of the Reformed Church. We simply asked them to repeal the wicked laws which turned us into criminals for refusing to affirm the doctrine of the Trinity. We wanted to be free from the duress and force of law, unfair law. And the Jews in the days of the Maccabees didn't want to be told that only the Greek way of religion, where art can depict God, was the correct way, the one pure way. But they had no interest in converting Antiochus to their views. They simply did not want to be forced. Eventually, only 100 years after Hanukkah, short hair was fashionable among the young Jewish men, not because the Greeks forced them with swords, but because by then they simply considered it fashionable. After all, their dear Greek friends who lived down the street wore their hair that way. And many of the Greeks became fascinated with the idea of the Shabbat, the Sabbath of the Jews, and began to practice it. Think of the story this morning. The fish borrows the wings of the bird borrows the fins of the fish. By doing so, they learned something. They grew. The bird didn't stop being a bird. The fish didn't give up fishhood. But they improved by flying above the rigid lines of them and us, you and me. Multiculturalism. It's been around since the Ark of the Covenant. But today, it's even more prevalent. Family-wide vegetarianism is not just found in the Gujarat province of India or in a commune in West Virginia, but in downtown Chicago high-rises. Yoga is not the personal devotion of Patanjali from the second century anymore. It's something practiced on High Street in Columbus in 2010 by people with Cherokee and Latvian names. Buddhist bells don't just ring in Kyoto. They sound at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Columbus, too. Even tattoos, which were once found mostly in working-class neighborhoods or in prisons or on horse ranches in Wyoming, can now be found in high school students in Worthington. And Native American genes are blended with African genes and European genes in a whole new choir of faces, beautiful faces, which the earth has never seen before. Wings set me free, we sang earlier. The wings that Levertov talked about, the invisible wings on our back that lift us up from the dualities of time and spirit, this and that, right and wrong, you and me. Levertov worries that we too often say no and feel those wings as burdens holding us down. Maybe so. But sometimes it's okay to say yes to the eclectic, to the blend, to the mix, to the both and. And maybe even especially in this season, we don't have to be ashamed at all to assert with joy that there are many, many reasons, mostly good ones, for the season. And aren't we lucky that that's so?